Hi, this is Delegate Steve Aarons, District 36, representing Kent, Queen Anne, Cecil, and Caroline Counties, and you're listening to the Maryland Association of Counties podcast.
Hello and welcome to the Conduit Street podcast. Kevin Canale back here with Michael Sanderson. It's glad to be back with the two OGs of the Conduit Street podcast. Michael, it's been a while since the two of us have joined for a podcast, and we're going to get through a lot today. But first, Michael, it's been so long since at least you and I've been on. Do you have any good dad jokes to open this thing with? I feel like we need to get it started on a good foot.
Oh, man. You think that's a good way to start or a bad? I don't know. We get flack for that. All right. Here we go. So I'm walking down the street the other day and minding my own business. And then I get accosted by six dwarves. Not happy.
Oh, I like it.
Hey, I'll tell you. All right. Dad jokes aside, though, I will say that I like that on the podcast, we've gotten into a flow of having our colleagues join and sometimes just run the show when we're doing an episode on a particular topic. And Sarah and Brianna and Dominic at various times have been either joining us or joining one of us or just moderating their own pod and so forth. But I kind of miss it being you and me. Like, we did lots and lots of episodes of this podcast where it was just the two of us kind of grinding through the news of the day, whether it was one issue or six of them. So I kind of like being back in the saddle with you, Kevin. I appreciate it.
Yeah, I like it. And hopefully, you know, we'll be able to do more of this as we get back into session, which is very soon. And Michael, I think part of the reason why it hasn't just been us other than, you know, our wonderful colleagues chipping in for their policy issues, it's felt like session for a while now. As we sit here at the end of November, things have been really, really busy. And today on the podcast, we're going to get through a lot of what's happening in Annapolis. There's a lot to talk through in terms of getting ready and warming up for session. We'll talk through MAKO initiatives that we're hearing about out there in the news and then in the various county visits. Then we're going to get into a few odds and ends. I can tease for you that we're going to talk about a drone incident that recently happened in Baltimore. We will probably debate Twitter and whether or not folks should still use it or X, but I refuse to call it X. I'm going to call it Twitter. So Michael, I mentioned hearing about things on county visits. You have been out with Howard County Executive and MAKO President Calvin Ball, meeting with all the counties. Talk a little bit about that. What are you hearing out there? Let's open right there. I think that's a good spot to start.
I think it is, and it does connect to a lot of the things that we want to talk about in this episode with sort of a rundown of what's going on and what's coming up. But for our listeners' benefit, you know, MAKO as an organization, our members are the elected officials in each local jurisdiction. So you might know us for our conferences and events. We've got a big event coming up next week in Cambridge, in Dorchester County. We always do our event in summertime. We do other events and things like that throughout the year on behalf of our professionals and smaller events, that kind of stuff. People know us for our policy advocacy in Annapolis, where we're at the testimony table talking about how to fine-tune a bill to make the implementation easier for the county governments who are going to deliver a service. People know MAKO that way, but part of this is just serving and representing and being guided by our members, the local elected officials. So one way we do that is over the course of each year, we try and get out to get on the agenda or have an informal meeting with the elected officials in all 24 jurisdictions. So we get out to Western Maryland and chat with the county commissioners out there. We get into the DC suburban area. We talk with the county councils. We go to every corner of the state and try and engage sort of at, you know, we play a road game. We come to them and sit before the county commissioners or whatever, you have breakfast with the county council or other things like that, and just chat them up, talk about the things we've been focusing on, and then listen to what they're interested in. So that's the setting for all these visits. I will say one takeaway here is Calvin Ball, as a county executive, first of all, he's got a really good resume for this in one specific way, that he spent over three terms on the county council prior to becoming elected county executive. So when he's sitting with the sort of legislative bodies for counties, he can say, you know, I've been in your shoes. I was a council member prior to being the county executive. So, you know, I was part of the legislative process, the deliberative process, not merely starting at the top of the food chain. So that's always an ingratiating moment. But I mean, he's got a background that connects with so many people in so many different ways. He's an education leader and was involved in nonprofits, but also with his community college and so forth. But prior to that, I didn't know this until we started doing these trips, that he was a trained paramedic and was actually like making EMT runs in Howard County. Yeah. A number of years ago. So as we've been talking, you know, one issue we've been talking about with almost every county has been our difficulty recruiting and retaining the next generation in fire service, whether it's career or volunteers. And for him to be able to drop in, yeah, I did that. I actually have that training and have done runs myself and have that exact background. That's an eye opener for an awful lot of people who, you know, sometimes like, oh, a big county executive, what does he have in common with us? We're the Caroline County Commissioners. Turns out quite a lot. So anyway, we've had a lot of productive conversations. Fire and rescue issues have been something we've been hearing about a lot all over the place for sure.
Right. And I didn't know that about County Executive Ball either. That is a fascinating tidbit. And yeah, I mean, of course, firefighter, EMS, both career and volunteer, there's a reason why that's on MCO's top four initiatives list. And last year, we were able to successfully introduce past legislation to create this commission who's looking at all these things and how we can retain and recruit the very best in the volunteer and the career realm. That commission is wrapping up its recommendations, Michael, and now you have a follow-up initiative for the 2024 session on MCO's top four to implement those recommendations again, because we need support at the local level, both at the career and volunteer level. And I know that is something you hear about at all these visits. I'm sure you also hear a lot about housing, and this is ubiquitous. It's everywhere. This is a national issue when it comes to housing affordability, workforce housing. It's certainly an issue here in Maryland, and I expect it to be a hot, hot topic of conversation in the 2024 session. Michael, what are you hearing out there when you meet with the counties about housing issues? Is this something, did I just screw that up? Is this not something you're hearing about? I bet the house that it is.
You're spot on. That it is absolutely one of those topics that's coming up everywhere. And I think the narrative is different in different places, but there are places you wouldn't imagine are having an affordable housing problem. You know, Garrett County in the far western reaches of the state in Appalachian Mountain, Maryland, having their own housing crunch. And it's driven by people relocating to further areas, you know, places like, oh, let's get a place over by Deep Creek and so forth. But I think whether it's you've got a crowded downtown area where you'd like to build density, but you don't have the infrastructure for it, or whether you've got a community where some passersby, where it's like a touristy type area, and you've got residential areas that are suddenly finding serious competition from Airbnbs and VRBOs and these like short-term rental properties, people just either building or buying properties, taking it off the conventional housing market so they can rent it out as a short-term rental. I mean, this wasn't a thing 20 years ago, but it's definitely a thing in a number of places in Maryland and I'm sure elsewhere too. And I think affordability, like the big shock for everything, has been the change in interest rates. That,
right.
You know, the ability to finance a project of any size at 2-4% interest a couple of years ago has become 7-10% interest today. And suddenly the affordability of a lot of projects has just cratered just as a result of financing costs. You pull all those things together and I don't think we've had a single county we visited who's told us, no, not an issue here. Nothing going on with housing in our place.
Right. So I think a lot of people equate affordable housing issues to urban areas. It's not just urban, it's rural, it's suburban, it's everywhere. So this also is on MCO's top four in terms of legislative initiatives for the 2024 session. We're looking to work closely with the state to come up with good ideas and tools to help everyone solve this crisis. Of course, local governments are a big part of that. And I think Michael Mako has been talking with all the right folks here, all the right stakeholders, definitely comes up in our meetings with the governor's team, with DHCD leading the charge here from the governor's perspective on housing issues. So definitely something that is going to be hot in the 2024 session. And I think, again, there's a reason why these initiatives are on Mako's top four. And these are issues that will be important and that counties play a very big role in. And again, speaking of that, Michael, another topic that's always going to come up, particularly over the last few years, but really always, education. And when you're out with these visits, the blueprint, Kerwin Commission's recommendations turned into the blueprint for Maryland's future, mm-hmm. big spending obligations at the state and county level. And Michael, we've gotten a lot of talk recently in the media with a letter that Mako sent regarding the blueprint. So I'm sure that's come up too. Let's talk a little bit about transparency and education spending specifically and what that means for the 2024 session.
Yeah, I think this is definitely a topic that's on the minds of our county officials. On the first level, there's a gut check issue for every county, and that is whether it's this coming year's budget or maybe it's a year or two down the road, everybody can see a fiscal challenge for their county being able to come up with the dollars that the blueprint is going to require. So, you know, our loyal, faithful, teeming millions of longtime listeners know you and I got super deep back when it was the Kerwin Commission and they were having all their, you know, deep contemplation and these national experts and, you know, all sorts of, you know, deep conversations about education policy and goals and outcomes and so forth. A lot of that has translated into redone formulas, higher expectations, and eventually a mandate that both the state and the counties come up with more resources to do the things that are envisioned in the blueprint. And when that obligation lands on counties, it's a little complicated, but it's going to land in different places at different times. But when you feel it, it's going to be a jarring effect on your county budget. And in some cases, they're saying, yeah, in for the 26 budget, we think we're going to need an increase of dollars for schools that's more than all of our tax and all of the increase in our tax revenues put together. So all of our county new revenues need to go to education and then some. So we'll have to go back and cut, you know, road resurfacing or public safety employees or other thing, you know, park and rec, other sorts of things just to sort of feed the beast of education. So to one degree, it's a funding issue. And for county governments, like, we're not in the curriculum business. We're not making education policy decisions. But there is a question of what do you bring to the funding authority, the county council or the county commissioners in the county government, when you say we need these extra dollars for education? It's to do these things in the blueprint and so forth. But how much detail and how much clarity is there now and could there be in that process? And I think we believe that adding some more transparency in that process would benefit everybody. And among the people who benefit the most will be the county officials who are going to either dedicate a big chunk of their county budget to education and their new revenues going to education, or even are, you know, raising taxes locally, saying we want to support these things, to be able to say, I've seen what's in the school budget and what we're buying with these extra dollars is important. You'll agree with me when you hear it. Here's what we're buying. I think everybody wins with that kind of visibility and transparency. So I think we're going to take a swing at that legislatively. We've got a number of folks who are interested on that front. You know, we're going to be invested in education. Let's do it with all the cards on the table.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's a no-brainer. And, you know, I think in the same way that counties are extremely transparent with our budget, you can go to any county website and you can see exactly line by line where the money's going, I think it makes sense, especially with this huge investment, that residents, constituents understand exactly how this money is being spent. And like you said, when people show up and ask a county elected official, hey, why are you doing this? Or why are you raising this tax? Or why are we diverting money from this to that? It's a lot easier if you have all the receipts in front of you and if you have all the information to be able to convey, because these, of course, are public dollars and people are going to want to know. So for me, no brainer. And like you said, I think a lot of people invested here, a lot of stakeholders. And I think this is a no-brainer. So hopefully the legislature sees it the same way. I think we do have a lot of allies in the legislature who, again, this is not about dictating how money gets spent. This is about just being able to see how the money is being spent, being able to convey that publicly. And to me, that makes a ton of sense. And it's in line with what the state pitches everywhere else, right? Is transparency, accountability, public input. That's what we're all about.
Yeah, I think so. And the common theme here is when MACO goes through its own sort of internal process, you know, we have a special committee that listens to all these different recommended top initiatives and recommends a slate of things that we should make our, you know, here's what the one pager walk around thing for January ought to look like. It's good when our membership is talking about the same issues that our leadership is. So, you know, we get in a room and there's only so many people you can have around a horseshoe to debate. Let, you know, should we do number 7 on the list or number 13 on the list or number 18 on the list? And let's take this one off and let's do this one instead. Or let's bundle these together. We have that annual process internally. It's reaffirming when we go out and sit with the county commissioners in a small county, the county council in a big county, and we're hearing the same issues that we've just adopted as our top slate. So I feel good about that. I think we're entering a session with a good deal of momentum on a number of these issues. I really want to move the ball forward on stuff with firefighters. The commission that we got last year is just about to drop its recommendations. And I think there's going to be a plate of good ideas for the General Assembly to consider there. This business with school transparency, I think, is a well-founded idea that's, you know, that we've talked to a lot of stakeholders about. So I think we're moving in the right direction on a lot of these things. You know, we're going to be at the table with everybody on housing, right? So I think it's a good slate of stuff.
Right. Good slate as we head into session. And Michael, things are certainly warming up for session. Again, this is November 30th. It feels like we've been in session for a while. It also feels like session is coming up really, really quickly, because it is. So, Michael, I want to set the table here and just talk about, we're going into the second term for legislators. We're really going into the first year for Governor Moore, right? He's been here. He was here last session, but this is really his first chance to sit back and formulate his budget the way he really wants to do it, to come up with ideas. Last year he was inaugurated in January, so he didn't have time to go through all of this. So it's really his first full session and preparing for session. But then also, again, you have a second year of a term for legislators. Michael, what typically are, I mean, you've been around for a long time. Yeah. You've seen a lot of turnover. What are the typical second year of a term expectations? And what have you seen in the past? Is there anything you can share in terms of what you expect from a legislator who's now in their second year of a term? Maybe they feel like they found the committee rooms and they know where the restrooms are. They know how to get around campus. Now it's time to potentially do some more work, drop some more bills. So what are you expecting for most people as they enter the second year of a term?
All right. I think I will say that I do very much subscribe to the 4-year cycle as the right frame of reference to be thinking about a legislative body where everybody runs on the same 4-year terms. So we don't have staggered terms in our state legislature. I don't know if that's a common thing elsewhere, but here everybody stands for election in the same 4-year cycle, the same time as the state governor. So our state election was in the fall of 22. We'll have another one in 26. But here we are coming into year 2 of a 4-year cycle. So it's almost like being a sophomore, right? Like it's almost like your 4 years of high school. The freshman year is, okay, everything's new and there's acclimation. And like, we make jokes about that. Like, you know, they don't even tell the brand new delegates and senators, oh, by the way, there's a professional staff who will draft up any bill you have an idea for. The joke [S2] Right. [S1] Around town is you don't even tell them in year 1 that that's available to them. You make it a, a weaning in process for everybody new. And like lots of new members of the legislature last year for their first session in 23, a new governor and new administration with a partisan changeover. That doesn't necessarily mean a ton tactically, but it does mean you'll have new leadership in a lot of state agencies that may not have been installed and confirmed and built up in time to do things like departmental legislation for the 23 session. And then, you know, some new leadership in the legislature itself, plus the attorney general and the comptroller and even a relatively new treasurer. It's just so much new in Annapolis. This should be the year that it's sort of like the paint is dry and you roll up your sleeves and you really get down to business. And that idea, like the most notable thing is probably going to be we should see a full slate of ideas from state agencies of things that they think need to be changed in state law so they can do things more efficiently or more effectively. They'll look at a process. They'll say, this seems outdated. Let's get rid of that. Or let's replace these two entities with one or other things like that. The new leadership in the Moore administration has had enough time now to solidify those ideas and go through a normal process. So usually that's like September, October through December is when the internal process of building out the administration's proposed budget, but also a proposed legislative agenda is all happening this time of year. That should be in full bloom for the legislature this year. And that will be a sea change for them to see state agencies coming in some cases with, you know, a half dozen or a dozen different proposals saying, we want you to do this. We ask you to do that. Here's the argument for it. It's just, it'll feel different. The volume of bills should be up. And I think people having gone through one cycle in their freshman year, now that it's a sophomore year, you just feel more fully fledged and ready to go. I mean, you've had that experience too, right? Even just testifying in committee, it feels different in year two, doesn't it?
Oh, definitely. It definitely feels different. And people definitely feel more confident, I think, and they understand the process more. They understand how things work. And they, like you said, feel more comfortable maybe to bring new ideas forward and finding out, again, how to find, you know, co-sponsors, right? And that's something you have to figure out, too.
Right.
And, you know, just meeting other members and figuring out the ideas that maybe you share and that you could work with on legislation. So I agree. I think there'll be an uptick in that. Certainly, we've seen a big uptick in administration bills. So coming from the various agencies, like you said, and we've been fortunate enough to meet with, again, the administration multiple times and talk to their folks about what their agencies want to bring forward and how those might affect counties. But I certainly expect an uptick, Michael. I know there's been a number of bills already pre-filed. So certainly, I think it's going to be busier. But it's also, Michael, we know that this is probably going to be a challenging session when it comes to the budget. And we've talked about this a lot. The governor at our summer conference in August talked about tightening the belt and the need for everybody to take a look in the mirror and figure out how we can be more efficient and effective with our dollars. Because we know, we just talked about the blueprint, the state is coming to an inflection point with the blueprint. And we know in the out years, not necessarily in the 24 session, you don't really have a problem. But as we get into the out years, you do. So it's very unlikely in my mind that the General Assembly commits to long-term new spending. And typically, that's what you need for some of these big, big ideas that cost money. You need that financial commitment. All the federal money is gone, Michael, that we had in the past few years, and that really buoyed things and kept things afloat. That's all gone. So it's also now a reality check for these sophomores and for the governor as he prepares the budget and how we are going to prioritize the limited dollars we have now and how to make, you know, longer investments without breaking the bank. So that's also something I'm paying attention to very closely.
Yeah, I think that's right. The fiscal stuff, and we talked about this a few weeks ago, sort of, I think, right in the wake of the state making a modest write down in its own revenue forecasts. But we were trying to say this is like a middle tier level of fiscal concern. And I think that's still where we are, but it's different from where we've been the last couple of years. So the closeout of the last 4-year term and the beginning of this 4-year term felt like almost training wheels fiscally, a little extra federal money, a kind of weird economy where revenues were strong, even more so than the economy felt. And that stuff, I think, is behind us. It's back to reality a little bit. And if we're actually looking in the years ahead with cost of living not being at a puttering 2 and 2.5% inflation, but if we're going to have 4 to 5% inflation and just the ability to continue providing the same service as the year before is going to cost you 4, 5, 6% more. If revenues aren't doing that well, if we have, you know, if the income tax and the sales tax are only jumping by 3, 4, 5%, then you have an inherent stress in a public service budget just to keep up with the stuff you've already committed to. So, like, that's the kind of stuff that I think the governor's fiscal staff and the legislature's fiscal staff are already thinking about. You know, they're worried about the coming year and what, you know, sort of paper shortfall exists for the coming year in the FY25 budget. But when you look for 26, 27, 28, it's easy to find those numbers getting slightly more negative each year just because of the moving parts underneath. So, yeah, I think that's where we are. It's going to be a tough year to come in and say, let's do $250 million of this forever. That's going to be tough.
Right. No doubt about it. And I think that is, I think that's the signaling is already there, again, from the governor, from the General Assembly leadership, that it will be different, especially for someone who's now a sophomore, who's never been here before. Things will be different. And we may get back to that fun stuff, Michael, where it's like, hey, if it's a fiscal note over X dollars, forget it. We can't do it. So keep your fiscal notes down. We may see some of that. But again, in the next session, there's not a crisis. They can certainly make the numbers work. But when you get into 27, 28, and you get over $1 billion structural deficit, you're going to either have to cut services or raise revenue. And that is just the reality. So we'll see what happens. And, again, not a crisis, but something certainly to keep an eye on. Another set of issues, Michael, that very, very hot. And this is a pun intended when I say hot. Energy issues.
Yeah, definitely.
Dad joke, right? Kind of. So energy issues are going to be a hot topic. They typically are, but I think especially when it comes to counties and how we play into this, Michael, there are two major issues sitting out there. And one of them has been out there for a long time, solar siting, solar taxation. The state has some very, very strong renewable energy goals and in the out years, and we need to get there. So there's a specific carve out for how much of that energy needs to come from solar. So there is a push to install more solar in Maryland. The question becomes, where should that solar go? Which entity should decide where it goes, how much public input you should have. And, if we can incentivize more solar on rooftops, brownfields, gray fields, that's certainly better than putting solar on prime soils and on ag land, right? So these are all questions when it comes to the siting and the development of solar. And then you have a tax question of, we've already guaranteed the business in Maryland. We've already said that Maryland is going to have to get a certain amount of percent of its energy from solar. So these folks, these developers already have a guaranteed business in Maryland. The question becomes, how much do we need to incentivize them to come here, even though we already have the guaranteed business? And of course, if you are a solar developer, you're not going to want to pay anything in taxes and say that it's worthwhile because it's renewable energy and it's good for the environment and it helps the state get to where it needs to be. But of course, this is a business and we want to be fair and equitable with our taxation when it comes to businesses and generally. So that becomes another question of how much revenue is the state and local government willing to forego to make sure that we meet our renewable energy goals when it comes to solar. So specifically on solar, Michael, these two issues when it comes to solar have taken up a lot of MACO's time. I'm sitting on and we have membership on this task force to study solar tax incentives. And then there is another, again, component when it comes to zoning and siting, and that has taken up a good chunk of time as well. So again, solar plans to be a major issue in the 24th session. Again, I think two tracks, one of them being tax, one of them being development, land use planning and zoning, stuff like that. Michael, are you hearing about that out there as well? Because I know this is a really, really hot topic for the legislature right now specifically.
It is a broadly interesting issue. We have a number of jurisdictions who have asked about it or talked about it with us during our visits. I will say it gets a little esoteric, right? We're not afraid to kind of get into the weeds on this podcast and talk about this as a residual mandate in legislation that was written back in the 60s or 70s for big power plants, including the nuclear power plant. And now those old laws are kind of being dusted off and used for big solar fields, which may or may not have been the original intention. I think some of this stuff gets a little in the weeds, but it's like, this is important stuff. We've had a lot of conversations over the years on this podcast about public policy constantly trying to catch up with technology. And, you know, we have a lot of laws in Maryland that were basically written around the assumption that the power grid is going to be sustained by energy coming from a handful of spots. We'll have an oil burning plant here, and we'll have five coal burning plants there, and we'll have one big nuclear power plant down here, and that's what powers the grid. And we'll have all these special rules because that's how power is made. And that might have been the case in 1970 and even in 2000, but in the 2020s, the idea of disparate sources of community level solar here and even industrial or utility scale solar here and there with this field or this entire plot of, you know, 75 football fields or whatever, all becoming covered with silicon and generating electricity. It's just a different game than the laws were written for. So I think we're in the middle of that. It's interesting. It's challenging. You want to be pro clean energy, but at the same time, you got to find a balance here. You can't simply just give away everything. Our communities need to have some degree of protection just for eyesight and for water runoff and for stewardship and for safety and a whole, you know, litany of issues like that that are legitimate issues, you know, alongside our drive for cleaner energy.
Yeah. So, hot topic for sure. And like you said, we could get really into the weeds here, but I don't think we want to do that. Another hot topic when it comes to energy, Michael, data centers. And, you know, this one, we know that Northern Virginia has really led the country in data center development. And these data centers are essential for the big, big tech companies like Amazon and Twitter and whomever else. They need these data centers to run their platforms. And so you need a lot of energy and you need giant data centers with these servers that can manage all of that. And they come with big revenue, Michael. And we've seen now a project in Frederick County. That project has been delayed several times. This is a massive, massive project and a lot of tax revenue, big, big, big tax revenue slated for Frederick County with this development. But it's run into some issues with the Public Service Commission. They regulate energy in the state of Maryland. And the way that they've sort of characterized some of their backup generator facilities and what that would mean for the environment, that's been a hiccup. And I think there have been some other snags along the way. But really, it's been, I think, the PSC's interpretation of what these backup generators mean and should they be characterized as a utility because there are so many of them. These generators only run in an emergency scenario, so it's not like they're running 24/7. And I think the argument has been that they should not be basically classified as a utility scale just because there are so many of them, because they're not running all the time and it's just for emergencies. So I think because this is such a priority for the governor to make Maryland sort of a tech hub, and he has specifically mentioned data centers before and trying to compete with Virginia, data centers also come with a lot of faster internet speeds and other benefits for the state. So it's something, again, along with the tax revenue that I think counties are interested in, but with this snag at the state level, that's, I think, giving some folks pause. So I think maybe we'll see an effort to sort of sort this out in the next session, but these issues and more when it comes to energy are certainly going to be, once again, hot topics.
Yeah. And like, that's why we're doing a whole breakout session on data centers and everything connected to them, both as energy and environmental policy. And we'll have Frederick County at the table talking about, you know, what they've tried, what's worked and what hasn't, and the way they've brought all sorts of stakeholders together to try and have a really smart stewardship program locally for this kind of technology. I mean, the fact is, though, that we are geographically in a spot that makes a lot of sense for us to host this kind of facility. So we've got every reason to try and thread this needle and figure out how to do it sensibly, sustainably, and safely. And I think, you know, this is exactly why a December conference to tee things up before the legislative session is kind of good calendaring for Mako. So that's a conversation we're going to have with state leaders and local leaders talking about, where are we today and where could we be tomorrow? So yeah, good topic. It's on our minds, but yeah, you're right. This one's heating up as well. And I do like the pun.
Yeah. I'm looking forward to it. I'm looking forward to that session at the Mako conference, and we will provide a link, of course, in the show notes to the conference. And we'll talk a little bit about that on the back end of this podcast. But Michael, I want to transition a little bit because I know, I mean, you're a football fan. You like the Ravens. You're from Ohio, but you know, whatever, you like the Ravens. You're fine with that. a couple Thursdays ago, Michael, the Ravens, they're hosting, I think, the Cincinnati Bengals. It's a Thursday night game. It's a nationally televised game. And all of a sudden, there's a delay in the game. And I'm looking at this and I'm like, what's going on? They're taking the players off the field. And come to find out, in Baltimore, over M&T Stadium, someone is flying a drone. And of course, that creates security concerns, safety issues. You have a lot of people in that stadium. The NFL certainly wants to make sure it protects its players and everything associated with those teams. So a drone flying over the stadium, no one knows who's operating this drone. That is a major problem. And then it happened again, Michael. Once they brought the players back on, they resumed play. It happened again. You saw this too. And I think we immediately thought the same thing. And tell folks what your first thought was when you saw that and heard that, and just a drone flying over M&T on national television. And what's the first thing you thought about?
Well, so I'm a confessed policy nerd, as well as being a recovering former Ohioan. But I will assure our listeners, I don't have any mixed loyalties. I'm a Ravens fan, even though in the division are two teams from Ohio. I have long since discarded my support for orange football teams. I'm all purple now. So nothing to worry on that front. But like when this issue happened, it just felt like the stuff we said at the witness stand several years ago when the General Assembly was taking up drone policy. It felt like exactly the things we were talking about came to life, that we were saying, you don't know what's going to happen as more and more people get access to this kind of technology. And it goes from being just scientists and just specialists to just now all sorts of hobbyists now can buy, you know, a couple hundred bucks. You could buy a high level drone that can fly hundreds and hundreds of feet into the air, and you can control it and multiple cameras and download all the images to the website and so forth. This is absolutely a big hobbyist thing. It's just a matter of time till there's some sort of crisis with people using drones that goes over a jail or over a wastewater treatment facility that's full of chlorine or other dangerous chemicals, or over some other sensitive sort of place. And you haven't thought of everything. You should let local governments have tools to respond to that sort of thing. And as you know, Kevin, we were told point blank by the General Assembly, no, we're going to preempt local governments from having any role in oversight or regulation or registration or anything like that of what's the term, like unmanned aircraft or whatever, some more technical term, but we're talking about drones. And so here it was, you know, some joker is flying a drone up to and over the stadium during a nationally televised event. And they had to delay the television broadcast a couple different times. And the cameras are on the silly drone and everybody's running around. People, I'm sure, were thinking, doesn't Baltimore have its act together? Can't they do something about this? And the answer here was, no, they absolutely can't.
Right. And That is something that still bothers me, that the counties, that local jurisdictions in Maryland cannot do anything when it comes to a drone. So if a drone is flying outside someone's window in the middle of the night and you call your local law enforcement, there's nothing they can do about it. Now, the FAA regulates all airspace. The Maryland Aviation Administration really takes the state role when it comes to this stuff, but counties can't do anything. So if someone's flying a drone over a public park and it's making people uncomfortable, there's nothing a county law enforcement agency or anyone else in a county can do. That all goes down to the state and to the FAA. So these are things that, again, we talked about, especially when it comes, like you mentioned, local jails. I mean, contraband, people flying drones around jails, that is a problem. If sensitive infrastructure, of course. So for counties to have no role, for Baltimore City to be able to do nothing about that, again, like you said, we said these things at the testimony table. I don't know if the state wants to revisit this policy, but I do know that the reason they wanted to preempt local governments in the first place was because you know, they wanted to make sure that Maryland was able to develop this technology, that businesses could use this technology, and they were worried that local governments would basically preempt them and that you wouldn't have the economic development potential in the state. I don't think that would have been a problem, but certainly when you see that on national TV, it's the first thing I thought about. I'm sure, and I know it was the first thing you thought about. It's interesting. Again, I don't know if it's going to come up in the next session, but that was a big fight, kind of a big back and forth. And now we're seeing, Michael, these hobbyists, and again, thankfully, there was nothing, I don't think, incendiary on that drone, and there was no malicious intent, just some joker. But that could have been a lot worse, right? I mean, you never know. Thousands of people, it's illegal to fly drones over groups of people, but obviously that person didn't care and there was nothing Baltimore could do. So I thought it was interesting, and we'll see what happens, but definitely concerning.
Yeah, and it's not like the Federal Aviation Administration, who nominally governs all this sort of stuff. It's not like they have field agents in every neighborhood, right? So when we talk about there being somebody empowered at the local level on these kind of issues, like, that's what we're saying. You can write a letter to the Federal Aviation Administration at their headquarters, wherever it is, and say, we're concerned about this thing that happened, and they might get you a letter back in a couple of months to tell you that they're concerned about it as well. But that's not the same thing as picking up the phone and saying, hey, there's a problem right now. This thing is flying outside my daughter's bedroom. And that's right. The kind of stuff that, like, you know, that's ground floor kind of stuff, not, you know, correspondence by firm letter to follow. Anyhow, you can tell I get fired up on this stuff. As a side note, it gave me a perfect entree. I had a welcome opportunity to be a guest speaker with Senator Shelley Heddleman at the University of Baltimore Law School a couple of weeks ago. And during an evening class for the legislation class, she was talking about advocacy before the state legislature and about local governments. And I gave a little briefing on local governments and where we fit in and what MACO does. And then I tried to talk about interesting issues where state and local authority overlap. And I talked about this drone stuff. It was a perfect example of who does what, and the state's the boss. They can tell us do this, but don't do that. It's kind of a good entree there. So everybody was familiar with that story. It would only happen a few days before.
Yeah. That worked out. But again, we'll see if anything comes forward in the next session to deal with that. Michael, of course, as we prepare and head into session, transportation, always a hot topic. We have a big commission here in Maryland to take a look at transportation revenue. And with, you know, the shift to electric vehicles, obviously they don't need gas. So we rely on gas tax revenue to fund our roads, and that's going to go away. So we've established this giant commission. MACO has membership. And I think our plan is we want to do a deep dive. I think we've teased this a few times. We want to make sure that we can get our members on with us to talk through this stuff, because it's pretty heavy. But Michael, does that sound okay to you? I know this is, again, a hot topic. We're following this commission's work very, very closely. But the bottom line is we're going to have to make some major, major changes in Maryland to figure out what we're going to do and how we're going to maintain our roads, bridges, infrastructure without a gas tax or, you know, a fledgling right. gas tax revenue. So the hot topic for sure.
Yeah, I think it's worth putting a pin in that. And let's get Todd Mon is the county administrator in Queen Anne's County, but he's a former county engineer and he's one of the members of this commission. But they're biting off an awful lot. You know, that whole idea of don't bite off more than you can chew. They've decided they can chew on an awful lot of stuff over their 2-year lifespan. Some of that's probably going to turn into legislative recommendations for this year, but they're supposed to be looking at infrastructure and financing and dollars issues and so forth. We had a local panel, a county government panel, came and presented. I had a large county and a small county person with me to present to this group and talk about the process for the state selecting state projects and some other stuff like that. So I think there's a bunch to get into. The big picture financing stuff is kind of sexy, but this group has taken up maybe a dozen different topics over the course of inviting in guest speakers and all that kind of stuff. It's probably worth its own episode. Let's do that.
Yeah, so definitely be on the lookout for that. We'll get Todd on to talk through those issues more in depth and get into the weeds a little bit more. And Michael, finally, before we close out today, you sent me a note that you wanted to talk about Twitter. And you wanted to talk, I don't know what you want to get into with Twitter, but I assume I'm going to be on my soapbox talking about why I think it's still a good platform to share information, even though its leadership is just amok and I don't even know what's going on, what they're proposing anymore. There's all kinds of different colors next to people's names and you pay for things and whatnot. But I feel like I've still been okay. The people that I follow and interact with haven't changed very much, and I'm not getting like all this extra bot traffic, but you may have a different perspective, and I want to hear what you want to talk about when it comes to this platform.
Yeah, I have like long form thoughts about where things are with Twitter or X or whatever people are calling it. I don't think I can break the habit of calling it Twitter either. But I mean, I know, I think you and I share this, that I have for a pretty long time used Twitter as a primary news source. Just, it's so expedient to follow news reporters on topics that I'm interested in. I follow our member county accounts and elected officials who are on social media. It's an easy way to see things that our counties are engaged in. So I use it for all that kind of professional stuff. I follow economic development issues and public health issues and transportation stuff. Like, I'm sort of a, you know, news and policy wonk and junkie, and it's a great way to stay on top of that kind of stuff. Just get the social media feed from the organization who follows that stuff or whatnot. So, and then like same thing politically, it's been really expedient to be able to say, thank you, Senator, for meeting with county leaders at our board retreat. We had a really productive exchange talking about these, you know, public safety policies. We look forward to working with you. And when we can say that to the senator, but also her followers, that's sort of a force multiplier that I think has a lot of value. Anyway, you know, with the site like changing footing, and I don't know about you, like I'm having a lot of trouble just locating things that used to show up in my feed routinely. So like, independent of, you know, what you think of the new ownership or the new management policies and so forth, which I know some people have problems with that, but like I get the sense that, you know, the Mako account, you know, we don't pay money for our account. I don't pay money for my own account, my own, you know, sort of Mako Twitter account. So we don't have the blue check mark, and we probably are losing distribution because of that. I don't know. Like, all this stuff is on my mind. I think it is with a lot of organizations and actors who have relied on this as a communications tool for a number of years. So it's on my mind. I mean, we're still using it. We still get a lot of traction when we post content from the Conduit Street blog, or we post episodes from this podcast on Twitter or on X. A lot of people pick that up, and we know traffic comes from things posted on social media. So I don't know. I have ambivalent feelings about what to do there. And I know you're a heavy Twitter user as well. Do you feel the same kind of stuff?
I mean, I definitely notice that I don't see all the same things I used to see in my feed. And there certainly, I'm sure, have been changes to the algorithms. And if you pay to be on Twitter, I'm sure your content gets bumped up a bit. But my thing is, I mean, there are lists that are very valuable. They had talked about Elon Musk, I think, had talked about potentially eliminating those, but he hasn't done that yet. So I still have all my lists. I can go there if I want to see a bunch of the same stuff from the same types of people that I'm following. But certainly, I think organically, you're not seeing as much of what you're used to pop up in your feed. But I also think that there's not anything else there that rivals Twitter, right? I mean, there have been other platforms that have popped up. People have tried, but you haven't seen this mass migration. And I think that the business model certainly is changing for some of these tech giants. And this is the norm moving forward. Maybe it's always going to be that you're going to have to pay to play. I don't like that. But again, I haven't seen anything pop up to rival Twitter. Twitter hasn't shut down. They haven't done anything drastic. I think in a little while, there was a lot of hectic activity there, but certainly I'd like to be able to go back to the days when I feel like things were populating more organically that I cared about. There are just random things now that seem to be popping up in random places that I don't understand why. But I still feel like there's a lot of value, particularly when it comes to news. If something's happening, you can quickly get onto Twitter and follow the local reporter who's covering that live and get sort of that instant information. A number of elected officials, both at the local, state, and federal level, all still use the platform. So I feel like you have to be on there. And there are enough people on where you have to do it. And if there are other platforms out there, I mean, I'm willing to try them. And we talked to Walter Olson about that, and he was generous enough to send us an invite to a new platform. But I mean, Michael, it seems to me most of the people that I followed before are still on the platform. So it's hard for me to say, yeah, well, maybe it's not worth it anymore. And again, I think maybe this is the new business model, and maybe this is just how it's going to be, unfortunately.
Yeah, I mean, I guess that's where we land, at least for right now. So I don't know. I mean, every once in a while, I see someone I've followed for years on Twitter make this announcement. They're going to Blue Sky, or they're moving over to what's the Meta offering. I'm forgetting now. Yeah. So it's like, anyhow, I guess we just bide our time. I mean, we're staying on the platform, not out of love, but maybe for lack of a practical alternative. I still want to be able to reach those people. I want to be able to read those people. And until something shows up that can help us do that elsewhere, this still seems like the place to be posting stuff and sharing stuff. I don't know. I mean, it's on my mind. I think it has to be for everybody who's transacting in this business, right?
Yeah, definitely. And I think one thing I want to see how it plays out is I want to see how it works during session. We have these hashtags, the MDGA24 and hashtag MDPolitics. We're used to seeing all of that information populate in our feeds pretty quickly, especially when everyone is tweeting about session and we're in the midst of it. So if it happens that there's none of that showing up during session and those hashtags and whatnot, that's going to be frustrating. And that, I think, is going to be telling in terms of how much it really has changed. So I'm really using, I think, session as a barometer to see how much of that stuff I'm still seeing, or how much of it I have to go and search for, where before it would just populate automatically because that's the stuff I care about. And the algorithms know that I like those hashtags and those are the people I follow. If that all goes away, that's going to be more of a challenge for me. So I'm looking forward to see how session goes in that regard.
Yeah, I think that's a fair summary of where we are right now. But I'd hate to see the utility of this breakdown. I mean, despite whatever our misgivings might be in the moment, the idea of an electronic town square is really attractive to a lot of us, I think. So anyway, I hope it retains its utility in that way. And yeah, this session might be a sort of proof of concept at this point.
I mean, let's put it this way, Michael. I don't know if you've seen or interacted with the Nextdoor app. If that's the alternative, then I'm done, because that stuff is crazy. And that's just going bananas. So I'm not using Nextdoor. I'm not using any of these other things. I'm Twitter for now. We'll see what happens. But yes, the idea of this huge, public information sharing platform, and it's wonderful. But of course, then there are people who want to monetize it, and that's capitalism, and that's the way it goes. So hopefully we don't lose all the value there, but we'll see what happens. And Michael, we've mentioned this a few times throughout the podcast, I think, but of course, next week, you and I, the Mako team, and lots of other people are going to be in Cambridge for the Mako Winter Conference, our annual conference, December 6th through the 8th. We will link it in the show notes. You should be there. You shouldn't miss it. There is a ton of content. And Michael, I'm excited for it. I know you are too. We just did a big team meeting this morning and talked through the whole conference and where everybody needs to be and all these different sessions. It really packed again. And I know that the numbers are really good. The hotel has been sold out. That's been challenging. I think we've sold out all the hotels in the area for this thing. But, if you haven't registered yet, you need to get on our website now and make sure you register, because this is really a can't miss at this point, Michael.
Totally agree. I think we've got terrific, timely, important content. Our members are going to get educated on stuff they don't know about. They're going to get further details on things they need to know about, and more exposure to the best practices around the state. So that's what we do best. We're gonna crush it once again in Cambridge. We're looking forward to another really good event and tee everybody up for success in the session ahead.
And I'm quite confident everything we talked about on here today will be talked about at the conference in terms of its own session. So that and a lot more. Don't miss it. Again, we'll put the link in the notes. Michael, anything else from you before we wrap up this episode of the Conduit Street Podcast? Anything else on your mind that you want to throw out there? We've talked about drones, Twitter, all kinds of policy issues. Is there anything left? And we did a dad joke. So is there anything left at this point?
I don't know. Have we gotten to Guam? Do we have any news from Guam? That's about, you know, like for the old school, I feel like, yeah, we should have dropped in some sort of Guam Easter egg. We'll try and be more committed to that down the road. That's about all we've missed. I know you and I were saying we'll run through this in 30 minutes. It'll be no problem. And I think we've been a little over 30, but hey, I'm feeling it.
I think it was good and worth it. So we'll leave it there for today, though we have gone a little bit long. If you enjoy the podcast, please go ahead and subscribe. That way, all of these episodes will be sent directly to the device of your choice. Of course, you can follow along on social media as well, Twitter, Facebook, and then, of course, you should be reading the Conduit Street blog. Again, make sure you're registered for the winter conference. Make sure you're in Cambridge in Dorchester County, December 6th through the 8th. It's a can't miss. But for Michael Sanderson, this is Kevin Canale. We're going to leave it there for today, and we will talk to you soon.